I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, and we're here with Ray Brown. Hi, Ray.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing great. We've traveled a bit around the country together, and I've learned that you are a passionate birder.
Well, you know, I like to call myself an enabler rather than a passionate birder, although I love birding, but, you know, we have so many guests on our show that are real high-level experts. Those are the folks that I learn from, try to follow them on bird walks as we did here in the Upper Peninsula. And, you know, you really learn a lot from folks like that.
Your show, it's on WGBH in Boston, is that correct?
No, it's on 15 stations around New England, most of the New England states, and also on a couple of public stations, actually, in eastern New York State.
But you did have a background being on air with WGBH, as I recall.
Right. I actually still work for WGBH, separate from the bird show. I actually host a classical show, which I did on a full-time basis for quite a number of years. I got more and more involved in developing the bird show over the past few years and gave up my full-time job, which is actually WCRB, which is the sister station of GBH, part of the WGBH family in Boston.
So it'd be fair to say that Ray Brown is for the birds.
That's been said more than once. Yes, I've heard that.
So what is the name of your show?
It's called Talkin' Birds, or Ray Brown's Talkin' Birds. Talkin' Birds is the short name of it, and it's talking with an apostrophe instead of a G. And so our website is talkinbirds.com. We always say, don't put a G in there, or you'll get a pet store in Albuquerque instead of our show. So.
And you have a podcast, a live digital format of your show, I understand.
Right. We do the show live, and we stream it live. And then we provide it through MP3 files to our other stations that run it at all different times during the week. And then, our podcast through our website and via iTunes, yeah.
As I know from being with you here and down in the lower Rio Grande Valley, you do it literally live on location, not in a studio, whenever you can.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, most of the shows are in the studio. We've done, I guess, 592 as of today. So most of them are in the studio, but we've sort of gradually increased our remote broadcast. And part of the thing this year has been because of the National Park Service's 100th anniversary, we've connected with the National Park. So we did our show a few weeks ago from Acadia National Park in Maine. So we were in Acadia National Park in Maine just a few weeks ago, our third national park of the year, Yosemite. And we were at Grand Canyon.
What added dimension does it give you? What advantage do you have auditorially by being on location?
You know, I think it's the ability to just see the place and be able to describe it a little bit, and then, of course, to talk with
and
people.
And you hear the atmospheric, the outdoor ambience behind you when you're talking?
You might have to use a little imagination for that, but, you know, what we do have is generally a live audience. So there's a kind of a different dynamic as a result of that, because you do get some feedback from the audience as you introduce your guests and whatever the comments might be. You might get some laughter or some derisive comments. Or we haven't really gotten derisive comments, but we have gotten laughter from time to time.
So very much alive and being on location feel then.
Yeah, it is different. And it kind of gets you up, I think, as any performer would feel in front of an audience, because you're interacting with a live
and reacting audience. To how they act and react.
Exactly, yeah, sure.
Recently, I understand that some guy at NPR was reading something about you and contacted you, and now you're selected to be on air on NPR on an ongoing basis. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, it was a couple of years ago, Tom. We had an article in the Boston Globe, and there was a producer for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday who had seen the article and I guess had a physical copy of it on his desk for I think he said a year and a half. He said, you know, I've been keep thinking to contact Ray to be on the show. And so he finally did call me up and said, yeah, I've had this article sitting here all this time and thought we'd try to do something if you want. And I said, sure, I'd love to do it. And so, this is actually starting last February. We did our first one with Scott Simon. We've done topics like bird migration, bird vocalization, how birds find their way, birds' memory skills, a lot of different things dealing with the attributes of birds. We did one or two on a trip to Panama that I took to the canopy tower there, talking about that and just the birds that we saw from there. The most recent one we did was really a really fun one, and it had to do with myths about birds.
Tell us a myth about birds. I like that.
One of them is the idea that people would see birds disappear in the fall, didn't know where they went, so somebody got the idea that they flew to the moon in the fall. And I think that came about because people would see bird silhouettes flying across the moon, so they put two and two together, got 5.5, and decided that was it. And, you know, there's others that suggested that birds bury themselves in the mud in the wintertime to explain how they disappeared. Then there are things like hummingbirds. How could hummingbirds fly any great distance? It didn't seem possible. So the theory was developed that they actually hitchhiked rides on the back of geese to explain how they could travel for such great distances, when in fact, you know, hummingbirds, ruby throats, will fly across the Gulf of Mexico, you know, on their own. So they're capable of some, you know, pretty serious distances, for sure.
You went to Nebraska, as I remember, and mm-hmm. you did go to the sandtail crane migration along the Platte, right? And that must have been really awesome.
Really spectacular. I think they counted or estimated 400,000 sandhill cranes that day. But, you know, when we were at where the prairie chickens were, I was disappointed to not go out. But then there was a good part to it for me, because it turned out it was 6 degrees out there in the unheated blinds that morning. So everybody was really chattering when they came back. So I wasn't as disappointed anymore. But, you know, it's interesting, Tom, they talk about temperature changes. I know in New England we're always talking about how variable the weather is, and if you don't like today, you know, wait till tomorrow. And so after that 6-degree day, we went further east in Nebraska, to heading up toward the Platte River, and it was 75 degrees. So that was a pretty big contrast, to say the least.
So tell us about, in your journeys following and watching birds and being fascinated by them, some of the coolest places, memories you have.
Well, certainly that canopy tower I mentioned was quite remarkable.
In Panama,
yeah. The canopy tower is an interesting place in itself. It's a converted Air Force radar station. So it looks like a giant water tower, but it's been converted into lodging. So there's some famous trails there. One is called the Pipeline Trail, which has a history to itself. In World War II, there was a concern that the Panama Canal would be shut down. So a pipeline was built to transport oil. As I understand, it was never used because the canal wasn't shut down. But now it's a famous birding trail. So we saw just amazing numbers of species, and as you can imagine, amazingly colorful. And the guides in these places, and particularly the canopy tower and family there, are just quite remarkable. And they're real true bird whisperers. Mm-hmm. They can find birds that I would think really were not there.
Talk to us for a moment about the most fascinating birds you've ever met that just are incredible, just intriguing to you.
That's really hard. You know, I guess I don't have the experience of some birders who've done really lots of world traveling, but I can still think of birds that I saw on Cape Cod that I think are strongest in my memories, partly because that was being a new birder. Of course, being a new birder, one of the great things is every time you go out, you see something you had never seen before. So that's always very exciting. But I remember seeing a fork-tailed flycatcher in Chatham on the Cape, and that's a, you know, a tropical bird rarely seen in the
northern. Got blown off course, or?
Yeah, probably so. You know, they do get blown off course. I guess what happens with some birds too is juveniles tend to wander a lot, and they can just end up almost any place. And of course, many birders will say that's one of the really exciting things about birding, is that you have an idea what you might see, but you also have no idea what you might see because things like that happen, and you could see something just extremely rare. And that, of course, really gets everyone all excited. And people go from, you know, thousands of miles to see a particular bird. Sure.
Well, there are birds, there's birding, and there are birders. And you spend a lot of your life talking to avid birders. Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the most incredible birders that you've ever met and talked to, and what made them so fascinating.
I guess the first person who comes to mind is Ken Kaufman. He's a noted field guide author. He wrote a book called The Kingbird Highway years and years ago, and became quite a bestseller, and still, I think, still does sell quite a lot. And he was one of those people, and I know other birders like this, who at a really young age just really became fanatical about birding. And he was one who dropped out of school, you know, I think when he was 17, and just took off to go birding and to study birding. And he tells amazing stories of what he had no money and traveled around. He got people, he talked people into letting him sleep on the back porch and those things. And this sounds awful, I suppose, but he even talked about using dog food as part of his menu because he couldn't afford to do anything else. And
that's a passionate birder.
That's true dedication right there. And there's so many people that have done things like that. I recently talked to a great birder who's become a friend, Don Kruidsma, and he's considered one of the great experts on bird vocalization. He's written a couple of books about it, Singing Life of Birds and another one called Bird Song by the Seasons. But he and his son, who was then 25, decided to take a bicycle trip from Virginia to Oregon, and his aim was to listen to and record bird song along the way. And his son was not really that into birding, and he wasn't also not into getting up before dawn. And so Don is one of those guys who can't imagine sleeping past dawn. You have to be out there before the birds get up. And his son's philosophy was, it's never a good idea to get up before the sun. So they had a little bit of a conflict, but he kind of converted his son, I think, to a birder, and he's become quite an environmentalist in his own right. But there's somebody who's truly passionate about birds.
Okay, the birds themselves, I know it's hard to distill down, but what most fascinates you about birds as a species?
I think it's just learning about the complexity of their behavior. I mentioned a little bit earlier about birds' memories, for example, which are quite amazing. And in some ways, birds have much greater memories than humans do. There's a bird called the Clark's Nutcracker. For example, it's part of the corvid family that includes crows and ravens and jays. And they're able to bury seeds in the fall and remember months later where they buried them in very specific ways and in very huge numbers. So it's quite something remarkable, not something I don't think a human could do. In that same family, there are crows and ravens that display some pretty remarkable intelligence. So just learning about that is probably the most fascinating thing. There's a particular species of crow called the New Caledonian crow, which has been found to be able to not only use tools, because there are other birds that use tools in a primitive way, but able to do it in a pretty sophisticated way, where they'll take not just a stick to poke into a hole, but they'll get a stick that they find with a little hook on it. So they can actually use it as a hook to probe into a tree crevice, for example, and pull out some tasty insects from there. So there's just some amazing intelligence that birds have. So that somebody said recently, you know, calling someone a bird brain is not the insult that it used to be.
Very good. Along that same line, I know we share the same fascination, and that has to do with long-range navigational skills.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right up there with among the most amazing things about birds, and the fact that they can travel to places where they've never been at all before. There's a fascinating study that was done in Germany, I think, a few years ago, where they used something called the Emlyn funnel. Emlyn was the researcher who came up with this. And they were using a species of European warbler, if I remember correctly. And the Emlyn funnel would consist of a platform that was an ink pad. and then a funnel above it. And what they discovered was that when it was time, a normal time for this bird to migrate, they would see that it was trying to fly in the correct migration direction because it would get the ink on its feet and try to climb up the funnel to fly. So they would see all these scratch marks on there. And the most amazing part of that was it would not only do that, but when its brother birds who were flying free would adjust their migration direction along the route, this bird would also adjust its migration direction at the same approximate time that the free-flying birds would do. So it just indicated this incredible ability for birds to intuitively understand these migration routes. And there's more and more discovery or more research indicating now about the bird's ability to follow the magnetic field of the Earth. And I think that's been known about homing pigeons and such for a long time, but they're discovering this in songbirds now. And some researchers suggest that, in a sense, birds can almost see the magnetic field of the Earth, and it actually does involve their eyes in some way that I think is not still quite understood. But there seems to be some connection between these little tiny magnetic particles somewhere in the area of the base of their bill and their ability to see something that indicates the magnetic field to help them on migration.
This is so fascinating. Only because we're out of time, I'm going to have to say au revoir. Sure. But it's been an absolute joy and a pleasure to learn more about Ray Brown and the world of the birds.
Thank you so much, Tom. My pleasure indeed.
And to learn more about Ray Brown's world?
TalkinBirds.com, no G in talking.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the Upper Peninsula in Michigan, where we've been speaking with Ray Brown.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting, Tennessee. Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada. Kim Schneider from Michigan. Elaine Masters in San Diego. Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon. Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas. And Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.